I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. In this episode, we talked to Montgomery County Planning Board Chair Casey Anderson about the housing shortage in the county and in the Washington, D.C. region, and really a condition that inflicts most large metropolitan areas in the United States. Often called the missing middle, the housing crisis in urban and close-in suburbs in America is a result of a government failure to manage the regulatory framework of land use, which is better known as zoning, which I believe is going to be the next big bone of contention in local politics across the country. In Montgomery County, we have set aside roughly a third of our land for the agricultural reserve and declared it off limits for new housing development. We have designated another third of the land for single family homes. And there's a mismatch between what our households look like now and the type of housing we produce, which is mostly single family homes. And certainly, we are not producing enough housing. The results are these high prices and housing affordability concerns, as well as sprawl and the resulting demand for our roads, which all ends up in the single biggest global crisis of our time, climate change. But first, the news roundup. If you're lucky enough to live in a masking state, don't make the mistake of visiting a non-masking one. It's not a perfect solution, but the decisions by Texas and Missouri to end masking is truly mind-boggling. The decision captures the central premise of this podcast about the centrality of politics in all public decisions, and no claim of scientific superiority will be honored if you get the politics wrong. The Biden administration opened its first migrant children facility. We are interested in traffic issues for many reasons, but most poignantly for pedestrian deaths. There is new official data that shows that traffic fatalities across the country increased an incredible 8% in 2020 over the 2019 figure. Given that fewer people are driving, my friends at the Action Committee for Transit observed tartly that traffic congestion has never been the cause of road deaths. In Annapolis, the effort to repeal the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, a special set of rules that protects police officers from disciplinary action, stumbled. But Anton's Law, a bill to restrict police use of force, just passed the Assembly Senate and is headed to the House of Delegates. Closer home, Montgomery County residents and leaders are calling on Maryland Governor Larry Hogan to open a mass vaccination site in the county. At a county council meeting, County Health Officer Travis Gales had some tough words for the state health secretary. While the state has argued equity to open vaccination sites in Baltimore and Bowie, turns out that Montgomery residents are driving even a couple of hours to snag vaccine appointments across the state. This is only possible, of course, for those who have cars and free time. The best answer might be for the state to have operated through the county health departments. We will see if the governor comes around on this. And COVID is continuing to have budgetary impact. County executive has proposed to the state that the Purple Line, the light rail system intended to connect Bethesda to College Park, single track through a critical tunnel close to Bethesda. This will save the county $50 million, but fully cause more headaches later on. Later in the podcast, Up County correspondent Andrew Sondry looks at budget cuts in his neck of the woods. I'll be back with Casey Anderson. Casey Anderson, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thanks for having me, Sunil.
Can you describe the problem of missing middle housing in Montgomery County?
I think there's two separate dimensions to the problem. The first problem is we just need more housing in general, particularly housing that's in places that are accessible to jobs, to amenities, whether it's bars and restaurants or parks and recreation or good schools or all the things that people want and need to live their lives.
Right.
And we're really not producing nearly enough housing. I know that's sort of a counterintuitive idea, but if you look at the numbers of housing units we've produced, we routinely produced in the 90s, as recently as the 90s, over 5,000 new housing units every year. And during the crash, that period of 2008-2009, we bottomed out at below 1,000 units in 2009. That recovered a little bit to be more like 3 to 4,000 units in that period around 2012, 13, 14, but then there was a huge dip again. So by 2016, 17, we're back below 2,000 units a year. So really maybe 40% of what we were getting in the mid-90s. And keep in mind that while all this is happening, populations continue to increase slowly but steadily.
Right.
We had weak wage growth, but we were adding jobs to the region and in Montgomery County. So if you're adding people, you're adding jobs, that's positive because that indicates that you're benefiting from an economically dynamic region and place, but not producing housing at anything like the rate that we would need to keep up. So the Council of Governments recently did a major study to try to assess how many
Let me stop you for a sec. Council of Governments is the regional council of governments in the Washington, D.C. area.
That's right. It includes representatives from all the area jurisdictions. So COGS forecasters tried to basically estimate how many housing units we need to keep up with. Well, again, we're talking about assumptions of very slow, maybe even anemic population and job growth. So this is not an assumptions based on the idea that we're going to attract another Amazon or something like that.
Right.
They forecast that really the region, our share of the regional total, we should really be producing at least close to 4,000 units a year. Probably, I think more like 5,000 units a year would be healthy because we have a lot of catching up to do after the past decade plus of very weak housing production. So however you slice it, we got to have more housing. And we have a relatively mature development pattern. You know, when the county was becoming a bedroom community of DC and DC was growing into a international capital city as a result of the New Deal and the Second World War and then the Cold War after that, we were in a position to accommodate, you know, a lot of greenfield development, a lot of farms being turned into subdivisions.
Right.
And now we're pretty much out of land. We do have some options. We could get rid of the ag reserve, but I think that would be a bad idea for a whole variety of reasons.
Right.
But the point is we need more housing and we don't have nearly as many options about where to put it. And
right.
I think that the problem of housing supply shortages, a lot of people are, I think, sympathetic to the needs of lower income people who struggle to find a place to live or struggle to afford the high price of housing. But and that's certainly an important dimension of this problem. But the other thing that I think a lot of people overlook is that housing shortages and the lack of suitable housing for people all across the spectrum of incomes is really an economic competitiveness problem. Because if you're an employer who wants to bring a life sciences, you know, firm startup to Montgomery County or the DC region or a technology company, you have a handful of people, you know, the CEO, the really highly paid people who are making, you know, $400,000, $500,000, you know, plus a year. Those people are going to be fine. They're going to find a place to live that's lovely and that meets their needs. But even the highest value add sectors of the economy are supported by a base of people who may be pretty well paid by most standards, but they're not making, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year. They might be making $60,000 to $80,000 a year. And that's a perfectly, not only is that a perfectly respectable salary, but it's really, we have to be able to accommodate the needs of people who are not making astronomical amounts of money, not just to put a roof over their head, not just to make sure they're not homeless, but to make sure that they have housing that they find suits their needs.
You said housing starts were up and now they're down, but there's a demand here. And ordinarily, if the market worked, the supply would grow to meet the demand. But it's not happening. Do you have an explanation for that? What is your hypothesis?
Well, I think this is about the political economy of real estate development. When you have a place that has a mature development pattern, it's been developed, and the opportunity for adding more housing involves either redevelopment or infill. By definition, that involves building something in addition or bigger. So you're almost by definition going to raise someone's hackles because people grow accustomed to the way things are. They bought into a neighborhood because it was.
But why is that a political economy issue? Why is that a political economy issue? Why is that not just simple NIMBYism or whatever else you call it? Where is the supply constriction?
The economic and political forces converge around pushing development outward. So that means there's significant political pressure not to build where there's already stuff and people. And there's economic pressure, or there are economic forces at work that make it easier in terms of cost to build where land is cheaper on the periphery. And the combination of those things tends to produce a sprawling pattern of development where you get people who are trying to commute from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C.
We have a new zoning text amendment in front of county council right now that seeks to address some of this problem, right? That wants to bring some changes. What does it do? Can you tell us?
Well, Councilmember Juwando has proposed a zoning text amendment that would allow, as I understand it, as many units as you can fit into a structure that would have been allowed as a single family house, you can build. So there are certain standards in the zoning code that govern how big a single family house can be. So there's setback requirements, how far from the street or from the lot line to either side of your house the structure can extend. There's height limits. There's various limitations. But let's say the lot coverage requirement in a particular zone is you can't cover more than a third of the lot. So if you have a 9,000 square foot lot, the footprint of the house can't be more than 3,000 square feet. Now you could build a really big house with, if you had a one-third lot coverage limitation where the height limit is 30 feet. That could be a three-story house times 3,000 square feet footprint, could be a 9,000 square foot house. And some people will try to build a 9,000 square foot house on a 9,000 square foot lot. I mean, you see some of that going on in some of the neighborhoods around downtown Bethesda, where you just get, you know, enormous, you know, I guess the colloquial term would be McMansions, right? So Councilmember Juwanda's proposal is, look, if you can build a house that big, then why can't you build a duplex or a triplex that occupies the same, you know, building envelope that would have been available with a single family house? Why is it impermissible to build a multifamily structure that is physically not larger than what some of these McMansions would be? I want to come back, though, before we get further into the specifics of what Missing Middle is about and the Juwanda proposal, to talk about another dimension of the problem, because it's not just about we need more housing. It's also we need different kinds of housing. And this is the most interesting thing I've learned, I think, in the last 2 or 3 years. So if you take nothing else away from this discussion, remember this.
Okay.
In 1960, about 7% of households in Montgomery County consisted of a single person living by themselves. The others were various types of family households or people living together, not necessarily related people. And it was about 60% of households consisted of married couples with children under the age of 18. So that would be the Leave It to Beaver family structure. By 2018, 25% of households in the county consisted of a single person living alone. And the percentage of those married couples with children, those households, were 28%, I believe, or 26%. So you have a drastic change. So you have a housing stock that's been built over time, and a zoning regime, a land use regulatory system that assumes that most households are going to be that conventional Leave It to Beaver type of family.
Correct.
But that's not what we have. Correct. We have proportionally 3.5 times the percentage of households that we did in 1960 consist of one person living by themselves.
Councilmember Juwanda's bill then addresses exactly that problem and allows smaller units to be built, right? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. And I would add, by the way, it gets even worse, because not only we've got this very dramatic shift in household formation, household sizes, but while that's going on, the zoning code and our approach to land use is not really changing over time to reflect that change. So we have about, over 35% of the land area of the county is zoned for single family detached houses. Now, again, you could have a single family detached house that's suitable for a single person, but generally speaking, that type of building, that type of housing is better suited to multiple bedrooms, families, et cetera. And so, and yet we don't have much land at all available for multifamily housing. It's less than 3% of the land is zoned for mixed use and high-rise residential, that sort of thing. So there are some exceptions there. Various accommodations have been made over time for townhouses in certain locations. But in general, we have zoned vast swaths of the county exclusively for single-family houses, and you can't build really anything else, and a very small part of the county for multifamily housing. And the consequence of that is, even as households are getting smaller, single family houses are getting bigger.
That's right.
Because, and it's not because real estate developers are have it in for single people. It's because if you have no choice, if the law says you can't do anything with this land other than build single family houses on big lots, then you're going to build the biggest, most expensive single family house that you can sell. So it's not surprising that the average gross floor area of a single family house in the 50s in Montgomery County was 1,567 square feet, a little over 1,500 square feet. By the 2010s, last decade, it was 3,700 square feet. There are about 18,000 older adult households in Montgomery County that have more bedrooms than people living in them. And, you know, some people like to have a spare bedroom for when, you know, the kids come back home from college, or you want a home office or something like that. But I think you can see it pretty readily that we have a very large mismatch. There's a mismatch between not just the number of housing units we have and the number of people that want a house or a place to live, but between the types of households that people are forming and the types of housing we have available, even if they can afford it.
We have a housing shortage, we have a housing mismatch, and Councilmember Joando has introduced a zoning text amendment that begins to take the first steps to address the problem. But also the council is Andrew Friedson, who has said that he wants to have this discussion only as part of the discussion on the general plan, which is due soon. How does the general plan address the missing middle?
Yeah, maybe we should back up and just explain for benefit of those who are uninitiated, what is the general plan? The general plan is a plan for other plans. It's a framework for other plans. And we haven't written a new general plan since 1964. So it's that'll give you some sense of the, you know, this is a sort of it's a meta plan. And it's called Thrive 2050. And that will replace the old general plan, which is known as the Wedges and Corridors Plan. We're updating that plan. And I think what Councilmember Friedson and a number of other people are saying is, look, the general plan of 1964 is outdated, and it says a lot of things that I think everybody would agree are just not in sync with, I mean, some of that demographic change that I was talking about household sizes. Obviously, in 1964, they could never have anticipated that a quarter of all the households would be one person living by themselves. Sure. So the general plan says a bunch of things like, you know, we must preserve single family zoning and establish neighborhoods at all costs. And, you know, that was a perfectly reasonable thing to say in 1964. Today, maybe not so much. So I think what Councilmember Friedson is suggesting is, look, there's a way to do this that is principled, that first starts with the general concept of we really need to revise the high level principles that we're using to guide our land use regulation. And then we can talk about the specifics. You know, the general plan update, Thrive 2050, is not going to resolve the question of how many, you know, units you can put on a 9,000 square foot lot in a residential zone. It will talk in general terms about the need to introduce different housing types, to have some way to allow neighborhoods to evolve organically over time to accommodate a little bit more intensity of development. And then the specifics or implementation of that will take place over a period of months and years. And I think nobody, including Andrew Friedson, is suggesting that we should wait years and years to get around to the question of how do you implement missing middle. We're just saying the planning board is about to deliver its draft of the new general plan to the county council next month. And the county council will take it up over the next couple of months after that. And then, God willing, they will approve it and we'll be done with that task. And then we can move quickly to the question of, well, how do you go about implementing it? And so that's where Councilmember Juwanda's proposal, and there's other ways to slice this missing middle problem. Will Juwanda, I think, was definitely ahead of the game in pointing out, we have these giant houses. Why is it that you can have a giant house and you can't have the same, you know, size building that holds two or three or four or five units? That's not the only way to do missing middle. It's not the only issue to be resolved. For example, one issue that's not really addressed in Councilmember Juwanda's proposal is what about off-street parking? In many cases, if you have to provide multiple parking spaces off-street, you are not going to have any room left for a house, or at least not a house that has two or three or four units. So we've had this discussion before in the context of accessory dwelling units, and the county council agreed that, you know, also known as granny flats, they agreed to relax some of the requirements for off-street parking. If you want to put an extra unit above your garage or in a detached structure behind your main house and you want to rent it out, you don't necessarily have to add two more parking spaces. I think with missing middle, we need to address with a little bit more detailed focus, well, where and how is it exactly that we can allow for additional units in a place where, you know, streets are narrow and on-street parking is constrained. And in the case of missing middle, it can be a very serious constraint on whether you could actually get any of this built, because, you know, it's fine to say you can have three units in a building the size of a house, but if you can't build it without providing, you know, six more parking spaces on the lot, you're either going to wind up paving the entire yard, which we don't want to see,
right?
Or you're going to have some serious issues with the economics and practicality of building that.
How would you like it to change from what to what?
The way the council addressed this with accessory dwelling units was to say, well, if you're really close to transit, I think they said, or reasonably close to transit, even within a mile, we're not going to worry so much about additional off-street parking space. I think that what I'd suggest at the time, and they didn't take me up on it, but I think I'm going to revive this idea, is that it's not just, are you close to transit? It's also, can we objectively measure whether there's on-street parking available? So, you know, some people came in and said, oh, my street is only, you know, 17 feet wide. It's barely wide enough to park on one side of the street. And I've got, you know, you can barely, you know, drive through the street because people are having to basically, you know, park with their tire right up there against the sidewalk just to give people room to get through. And if there's only parking on one side of the street, then the houses on both sides, if they've got an extra car, you know, may be parking up the block. Well, okay, I think that's true in some cases, but in most cases it's not. I mean, I've been to neighborhoods where the street's, you know, 50 or 60 feet wide, and, you know, every house is, you know, on a big lot, so they've got, you know, plenty of frontage. And so there's got to be a way to objectively evaluate whether or not there's sufficient on-street parking.
What's the change you'd like to see?
My thought was that if you have sufficient frontage and parking is legal in front of your house, exclusive of clearance for fire hydrants and driveways, to have an additional parking space, then that ought to count instead of forcing you to put the parking space off street. So for example, if I have a house that's got, you know, 80 feet of frontage, the typical parking space is about 20 feet long, and maybe I can't use half of it because there's a fire hydrant in a driveway, you know, in front of my house. But if I have 40 feet of clear space, that should be enough to park two cars. The key is to make sure that that can be evaluated objectively, so you don't have to go in front of a hearing examiner or the planning board or a judge or the county council every time your neighbor says, well, I don't want you to build this because I don't think you have parking. We need to make that an objective standard so we can say, yes, you do, no, you don't, as opposed to having this be the subject of some discretionary review process, because that creates such tremendous uncertainty.
The planning board gave the county council some comments on the zoning text amendment, including some on the size of the buildings that could be built. Where do you want to go with that?
My thought is that a number of other issues have to be addressed in this. It's not just about what lot size and parking and how big can the structure be. It's also questions like, well, if you assembled more than one lot, should that give you the opportunity to build something bigger? Like maybe you might say, look, if you've got a 6,000 square foot lot, we don't really think it's reasonable to build a, you know, a three-story apartment building with a footprint of, you know, 2,000 square feet with, you know, 10 units in it. Mm-hmm. But if you bought two or three lots in a row, maybe a 10-unit building is not unreasonable, depending on its height and its massing and how, you know, other factors that may make it, you know, coexist harmoniously with its surroundings. So these are the kinds of questions that I think, you know, Councilmember Juwanda didn't really get into. And I think his intention was just to start this discussion, and that's in that he's been successful. But the point is not that there's one right way to do it, but just that there's a lot, there's different ways to approach this. There's, you know, you could look at this in terms of access to transit or only in the most urbanized, you know, areas. I think we should allow some kind of organic evolution of residential neighborhoods all over the county, but that doesn't mean that the same thing is appropriate in Poolsville as is appropriate in downtown Silver Spring. So it's not just a question of how big is the lot, how much parking is there, but what's the other land use context? We're not really interested in seeing, you know, small apartment buildings popping up in you know, the middle of Dickerson, right? Or Boyd's.
Well, that's a market driven phenomenon, presumably. I've been in Montreal, for instance, and you have, you know, in the suburbs of Montreal, you'll have, you know, single family homes and a, you know, 4-story walk up and a, you know, a little mini mart and then another home. And so this raises the question of, you know, I think you said harmonious coexistence, right? Harmonious coexistence is a term of art, really.
Well, I actually use that phrase because it's not a term of art. The term of art is compatibility. And, you know, that term compatibility is often abused because it's so nebulous that it could mean I don't want to say it could mean all things to all people, but it could certainly mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. And so even though it does have, you know, legal resonance in the zoning code, it has to be applied in various discretionary, you know, review processes. One of the things that we're proposing in the new general plan is to try to get away from that idea and try to be more objective about it. So one of the things that we've done over time, especially as there's been more demand for more, you know, urban mixed use types of development, we have rules which establish how tall some of that type of development can be when it's next to a single family neighborhood. So there's this idea of an angular plane. It's like a, you know, at a 45 degree angle. So if you are right next to a house that is, and you want to build a tall apartment building or office building, you're going to have to either move away from the house such that a 45 degree angle from that house does not intersect with the top of your office building, or step down that structure so it's not so tall, so close to your house that you're sort of like, you know, you've got this giant building that's looming over this, you know, one story little single family structure. So those are the types of things I mean when I say we're going to get away from these kind of vague concepts like compatibility and try to establish more objective standards. That's really important because if we try to punt the issue to hearing examiners, administrative law judges, these kind of processes, say, well, you go sort it out and the neighbors can have their input. The problem with that is you can't make a viable business proposition out of building any of this. You know, tear down builders.
Yeah, I mean, I changed my fence. I replaced my old fence, and I had to get a letter from my neighbors to replace my old fence, which is just ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and you know, the other part of this, I think people need to understand who don't love the idea of missing middle housing. They say, I don't want to live next to a duplex. And besides, you know, say, you can't guarantee me it will be affordable. What I can guarantee you is, because it's happening, it's not a prediction. This is observed reality, that in neighborhoods like mine, I live in Woodside, just on the edge of downtown Silver Spring, or places like Edgemoor, mm-hmm. on the edge of the Bethesda Central Business District, prices are going up to the point where older, more modest houses are getting bought and torn down and replaced with giant single family houses. So the question is not, would you like a duplex or a triplex, or would you like things to stay just the way they are? The question is, would you like to have your entire neighborhood basically be a target for teardown builders to build McMansions, which will serve only the very affluent? Or can we take the edge off of that affordability problem and create more housing that's suitable for a broader range of people at relatively more modest incomes by allowing some moderate degree of intensification, like duplexes and triplexes, and maybe even some small apartment buildings in certain locations? So
I get the public good argument. Hold on a minute. I get the public good argument. But from a purely sort of self-interested point of view, if they are breaking, you know, tearing down and building McMansions in your neighborhood, then your property prices are going up. So you have an incentive, right, not to want duplexes or triplexes, and to prefer McMansions, you know, so that your property prices go up.
Well, this is interesting. A lot of the opponents, I think, have their economic stories kind of confused. Because a lot of folks say, I don't like this because it's going to destroy my property values. And then the next breath, they'll say, well, I don't like this because it's going to eliminate affordable housing. Well, it can't be both.
My last question to you is about social housing. We have these examples of Vienna and London and in Annapolis, Delegate Vaughn Stewart is trying to get something going, and California has a bill. What are your views on social housing?
Well, I think we should try it, but I'm skeptical that it's going to get us much more housing. University of Maryland hosted a group of experts from Vienna about a year and a half ago that I attended, and they described how Vienna has produced social housing, and this is sort of showcased as, you know, a great example of how this can be done.
Sure.
And it became clear over the course of these conversations during this workshop that Vienna spends roughly twice as much as Montgomery County does. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. In fact, I think we should probably try it, at least on some limited basis. One way we could try this in a specific context that I think might get a lot of support is for teachers. What if we put housing on some school sites? What if we built a small apartment building on the grounds of a high school and allowed teachers to live there at reduced rents as long as they continue to work for the school system?
Casey Anderson, thank you so much.
Anytime. Take care.
What lessons should we draw from my conversation with Casey Anderson? The housing shortage we have today is an artifact of political decisions made before and immediately after World War II about how new suburbs were built across America that were intended to exclude non-white people and to both subsidize single-family homes at the cost of multifamily apartment buildings. Farhad Manju in the New York Times wrote about the soft apartheid of zoning, a topic Dan Reed, who writes a local blog just up the pike, has plumbed deeply in the case of Montgomery County. We are in the midst of a housing crisis, as some broad trends have converged and our political system seems unable to respond adequately here, as it has been inadequate in other areas. The top 20 to 30 metropolitan areas in the country account for the fastest growing parts of the nation. But since these cities were already settled and ringed by single-family homes in many cases, bringing change that will alter the character of neighborhoods is going to see resistance. The fight over single-family zoning is going to be the next big fight in jurisdictions such as Montgomery County. And for those who look to Berkeley, California as their North Star, I'm talking to you, Tacoma Park, they just decided to do away with single-family zoning. The political economy of real estate development in the county has led to a situation where only 40% of the estimated demand for new housing is being met. And it is not surprising that house prices, as well as rents, are going up fast. Unless the supply situation is addressed, it is unlikely that rent control will work. The takeaway from Casey's point of view is that Montgomery County has seen a dramatic change in what constitutes households. The leave it to be for a family of mom, dad, and two kids has become a minority in the county, but our regulatory structure is still stuck in the past. Before I end this segment, let me say this. As chair of the county planning board, Casey Anderson is not an elected official. He is appointed, and he describes himself, at least on Twitter, as a low-key technocrat. But he will be the first one to acknowledge that his job, his approach, and his methodology are political. Casey told me he came to I Hate Politics for the Joe Rogan Experience. We were going to talk for 3 or 4 hours until we were done, right? Alas, the interview lasted just over 1 hour, and then I had to cut it back to less than 35 minutes, you heard. I cut a lot out that I wish I had kept. I'll be back with Andrew Sondry, who's upcoming. Hey, Andrew, how are things going up county?
Great, thanks for asking. This week, I'd like to talk about budgeting, specifically how we do or don't get spending for various infrastructure projects, roads, schools, public transit, the whole thing, because that's all taken a huge hit from the COVID-induced recession.
What cuts are you seeing up county?
There's a delay in the completion of the Observation Drive between Germantown and Clarksburg. This is the final phase of that road that would connect the existing portion of Observation Drive near Waters Discovery Lane in Germantown with an extended Little Seneca Parkway out in Clarksburg, where there's a lot of new housing that's gone up in recent years. The Capital Improvement Program budget was released by the County Executive's Office back in February, and it pushed back the start time for that extension from fiscal year 2022 to fiscal year 2025. With the actual physical construction not starting until after 2026, which is a massive delay for a project that's been on the Clarksburg master plan since 1994. And it's nominally attributed to the budget shortfall as a result of COVID.
How is the county council responding to this?
The council actually debated this specific delay with the in the Transportation and Environment Committee last week, with the members of that committee all pretty much unanimously agreeing that they want to keep the project on schedule and begin the planning phase as soon as humanly possible. What became increasingly clear to me, though, as I was looking through old budgets, is that the reason that the upcounty got so few delays in terms of their projects was that there just weren't that many projects to begin with.
So is this all a backhanded insult to upcounty?
In a way, it seems to me more that the big story here is not what's noted as delayed in the CIP, but what isn't there at all, or is there but doesn't really have a timeline or, you know, the real kind of funding that it needs to begin. A lot of these projects that were included in early master plans or have been pushed by the community for decades, but never seemed to make it that far. The Clarksburg Town Center, for example, the monorail to Frederick, which was in the Washington Post this morning, of course, the M83 Mid-County Highway, which I know is controversial. But a third of the county's population lives up here. Two of the three most diverse cities in the entire United States are in the up county. And we're growing at a rate that's unmatched by any other part of the county. And yet it seems to take decades to get any projects that locals are advocating for, from a master or sector plan to a budget to actually being built.
I hear you. So some of these projects are highways and others are transit. How do you balance between them?
Yeah, that one's complicated. And I'll be honest, I don't know the perfect balance between roads and public transportation. Although I do know that there's always going to be some combination thereof. And I think everybody sort of agrees that in the specific context of the Up County, there'll be some combination thereof. One of the greatest frustrations to residents, though, is that we're just not getting much of anything. We're not getting either, really. The county exec has these budget town halls every year before putting together the CIP. But so few of the projects that are pitched by Up County residents actually make it into that final budget. I think it's why so many of us who live up here feel so slighted a lot of the time.
Well, isn't the problem that Up County doesn't vote in large enough numbers like Down County?
It's definitely a problem, but it's not the only problem. There's a lot of factors at play here, and I'd like to point out that we actually had huge up turnout in the 2020 election. A lot of people were motivated by then President Trump, but also we had two local initiatives on the ballot that a lot of people had strong feelings about regarding whether or not we should have 9 single member districts or 7 districts and 4 at large. But I think that issue drove a lot of people to the polls as well.
Well, Andrew, let's set aside some time to talk about 9 districts in a later episode.
Gladly. I look forward to that.
Thanks, Andrew. You can reach Andrew with story ideas about Up County at sondri.andrew@gmail.com or on Twitter at Andrew Sondri. Sondri is like laundry with an S. I want to thank the guys at Ed's Not Dead Podcast for pointing me to this journey into podcasting, and AJ Campbell for early help, including making the logo art. Our music comes from the local band Soul Witness. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone who might want to do it, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at IHPpod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.